Yes, I love it.
Sweet, he's giving me 300 boxes of grape nuts flakes.
Friends anybody ever had. And it's funny, but I feel as if I've known you all the time.
I love music, good music, but not swing. I sing.
Hi, and welcome to the Movie Magic Podcast. Each week, we will dive into a certain star and talk to some people who know much about him. I'm Kate, your host, and welcome to the Movie Magic Podcast. Hope you enjoy it. Hi, and welcome to the Movie Magic Podcast. Tonight's episode is Carol Lombard, and we will be talking with Olympia, a researcher on Carol Lombard. I hope you enjoy the episode. Olympia, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Kate, how are you?
Doing good. How are you? Are you ready to talk all things Carol Lombard?
Always, yes.
Great. So, Olympia is our Carol Lombard expert. You probably know more about her than I do. So,
I've been researching her for, like, probably half my life.
Oh, wow.
It's been a journey.
Oh, wow. So, and don't you have a book about her?
I do, yes. It was my PhD dissertation, and then I published the book in February.
Oh, how wonderful. So, without further ado, why don't we get started? Why don't you tell us when and where she was born and a little bit about her childhood?
Awesome. So, Carol was born Jane Alice Peters on October 6, 1908. So, she just celebrated her birthday last week.
Mm-hmm.
Her parents are Fred and Elizabeth Peters, or her mom was known as Bess to everyone in her family. And she was born in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And she had two older brothers, Fred Jr. and Stuart. And the family was pretty well off. I would say they're like a middle upper class, if not upper class. They were sort of like a fixture on the Fort Wayne social circuit. Carol's maternal side was quite wealthy. Her great-grandfather, during his time, he was considered like one of the richest men in Fort Wayne. Mm-hmm. He invested his money in a lot of industries, so she had a comfortable childhood in that sense. However, I think there was a lot of tension between Carol's parents, and that stems from an accident that her father suffered prior to their marriage. He was in an elevator accident.
Oh.
And that left him, I'm like terrified of elevators, so that's like, sounds very traumatic to me.
Mm-hmm.
He had like long-lasting brain injuries, I guess, that would cause severe headaches. And he, I think, would be a little bit aggressive, if not abusive, towards his wife and their kids. So I think her mom, as the kids got older, realized that it maybe wasn't the best environment for them. So she took her children and they moved to California in 1915.
Mm.
So that's how she got to Hollywood, and they settled in L.A.
Mm-hmm. So how did she get the acting bug?
So, actually, she starred in her first ever role at the age of 12 in 1921. And this was the film A Perfect Crime, and it was directed by Alan Dwan. And she got this role really by accident. So she was playing baseball with her brothers and some neighbors in the street, and Dwan happened to be, passing by, and he noticed that she was playing baseball better than all the boys, and that she was really spunky and quite athletic, and he thought that she would be perfect for this role in his film that he hadn't yet cast. So he asked her mom's permission, she said yes, and Carol did the part. And I think that was sort of the first sort of realization for her that she liked acting, that it was something that she maybe wanted to do in her future.
Mm-hmm.
And by all accounts, she had a really fun time working on that film.
Oh.
And then, yeah. So really, though, after that, although she was a child at the time when she did that role, she didn't really have a career as a child actor. She spent the majority of the rest of her youth really away from the industry, although she did take acting classes and she even, auditioned for people like Cecil B. DeMille and Charlie Chaplin. She was up for a part in The Gold Rush, actually, but obviously she didn't get it.
Mm.
But she, by all accounts, she had a relatively normal uneventful childhood.
Mm-hmm. So,
go ahead.
I was going to say, so leading up to this, how, you know, so she's doing these films, what were her earlier films, if you know any of them?
Yeah, so basically after that, she signed a contract with Fox, mm-hmm. and that was the time she spent at that studio was really sort of like an education for her in like filmmaking. She made a bunch of westerns there. Some of them are lost, so I've never seen them. But films like Goldwyn, I know, right? I feel like whenever you study somebody who worked in silent cinema, there's always like one or two titles in their filmography that are lost.
Yeah, I know there's a lot of silent era stars whose filmographies are just incomplete because they're all lost.
It's frustrating, right? Because you can only do so much as a researcher, but, you know.
Yeah.
What can you do?
Yeah.
Yeah, so she worked at Fox for a few years, and then in 1927, she signed with Max Sennett, who, listeners who may not know who he is, he's sort of like the king of silent comedy. He founded the Keystone Film Company, and he had a very prolific career as a filmmaker and producer. And so she worked for him for about 2 years, and she made about, I'd say, like 18 or so, one or two real comedies with him. She was one of his Senate girls, and they're essentially used, these are young women, basically, who are used in sort of, at times, exploitative fashions. They were dressed often in bathing suits. These films sort of emphasized like their beauty and their youth. And so she was one of those girls. I think in addition to her time spent at Fox, her films with Max Sennett were again an education. I think Sophia mentioned on the podcast that she was on that Adrienne Doré was in The Swim Princess, and that was a film that Carol also started, which I didn't realize until she mentioned it, that they had worked together.
No.
Yeah. So, most of her silent comedies are not available to watch, but I think Run, Girl, Run is available on YouTube, and it's really cool, and I would suggest listeners would check it out if they are interested in Carol. I think it sort of gives you a good sense of, like, her proficiency as a comedian.
Yeah.
And then, basically, after her tenure with Max Sennett, she signed with Pathé briefly, and then she worked. She moved over to Paramount, and she worked at Paramount. She's under contract at Paramount for 7 years until 1937.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say, though, before we get to her work at Paramount, I want to say, during the time she was working with Max Sennett, she herself suffered very serious injuries in a car accident.
Oh.
And she thought so this happened in 1927. This was just basically at the start of her time working with Sennett. So in September 1927, she got into a severe car accident. Her boyfriend was driving, and he was a bit reckless. He crashed into another car. The windshield shattered, and, like, glass basically cut her face from, like, her eyebrow to her nose. She obviously went to the hospital. She had surgery and plastic surgery, and I think this accident, she thought it would sort of be the end of her career. She was just starting off, and obviously Hollywood, like, really sort of fetishizes physical beauty and sort of like perfection, right? So
yeah.
I think for her to have this like very noticeable scar on her face, she thought, oh my god, my career is over. But thankfully it wasn't. But that was like a huge turning point for her in terms of like how she approached her career and her life. So that was pretty significant.
So let's talk about these Paramount movies.
Yes, so she was, as I said, she was under contract with Paramount for 7 years, and to be quite frank, I think at the beginning of her career with them, they didn't really didn't sort of like know what to do with her. Mm-hmm. At the very beginning, like basically up until 1934, she was considered like a Hollywood glamour girl.
Mm-hmm.
And she was cast in a series of films at Paramount and elsewhere that really emphasized this like glamorous persona. So like The Eagle and the Hawk,
mm-hmm.
Which co-stars Cary Grant and Frederick March.
Mm-hmm.
No More Orchids with Lyle Talbot, and We're Not Dressing. And these films, in my opinion, they don't necessarily, they didn't push her as an actress. She sort of just existed in a lot of these, especially in a film like The Eagle and the Hawk. She sort of just existed in this film just basically like to be beautiful. That was sort of like her function.
Mm-hmm.
So in fact, a lot of her success during that tenure with Paramount was on loan out. So they loaned her out quite frequently to studios all around Hollywood. So like some of her best known films, like 20th Century, My Man Godfrey, Nothing mm-hmm. Sacred, they were all made at studios other than Paramount. I think that sort of like speaks to the idea that they didn't really know what to do with her as a star or as a performer.
Mm.
Which I guess is, I mean, she was very successful despite the fact that they didn't know what to do with her. But so I guess we should talk about her screwball comedies.
Yes.
Kind of what she's most known for.
Yes.
So her first screwball film was 20th Century, and this was released in 1934. And 20th Century is really considered like one of the first screwball comedies, along with It Happened One Night.
Mm-hmm.
And they're both released the same year, but they had very different like trajectories at the box office. 20th Century didn't really do that well. I think critics and audiences found it a little too highbrow.
Mm-hmm.
I personally love it. I think it sort of is like a quintessential screwball comedy. It has like everything you would associate with the genre. It has like the zaniness, the sort of antagonistic screwball couple, so I think it's really fun.
Mm-hmm.
When Carol was cast in this, she starred opposite John Barrymore, and at the time she was still relatively early on in her career, so I think mm-hmm. to be cast opposite him was very intimidating, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because he's legendary, right?
Oh, supposedly so, yes.
Yeah. So I think when she first started work on that picture, she was kind of like holding back a little bit. And so apparently Howard Hawks, the director of 20th Century, he pulled her aside at one point and basically said to her, how would you feel if you were being spoken to like John Barrymore's character speaks to your character Lily Garland? And she allegedly said, I would kick him in the balls. And he said to her, well, like, harness that energy and bring that to your role. And I think after that, she really sort of gave everything she had to her performance, and I think it shows in that film. She like is outrageous. She's very loud. She's boisterous, and I think she sort of she carries her own alongside John Barrymore.
Mm-hmm. I've never seen 20th Century, so I wouldn't know.
You should. It's so good.
I know. I need
it's
to see
loud.
It.
It's like a lot. It's like overwhelming a little bit.
Uh-huh.
I'm not gonna lie, but it's a really good film.
Mm-hmm. And then My Man Godfrey, is that another one of her screwballs?
Yeah. So My Man Godfrey was another loan out, as I said before. So that was made at Universal in 1936.
Mm-hmm.
And so she got that role largely thanks to her then ex-husband William Powell. So he was cast first as Godfrey. And he basically said to Gregory LaCava, the director, and the producers, you have to cast Carol. There's no one else who can play this character. And so they did. And this was the first and only time that Carol and Bill Powell worked together after their divorce. And we can get to their marriage, I guess, in a bit.
Yeah.
Have you seen My Man Godfrey?
I've seen bits and parts of it. I've seen bloopers.
Oh my god, the bloopers are legendary.
Yes. He's like, I don't really care about you. Ah! She just runs away, and I'm like, Carol, I love you. I don't know much about you, but I love this.
Yeah, those bloopers, like, sum up her personality. Like, she swore a lot in real life, and I think those are hilarious.
Oh.
So My Man Godfrey was a huge success. She was nominated for an Oscar, along with William Powell. The film was also nominated. Unfortunately, everybody lost, but I think for her it was still quite an honor. Unfortunately, I mean, even it's still true today, comedy is sort of neglected by the Academy, but I think it's still a big deal that film got as many nominations as it did.
Yeah, it seems like it. And what are her other ones?
So another big one is Nothing Sacred, and that was made with David O. Selznick at Selznick International. That came in 1937, and she stars alongside Frederick March. And that film, I think, is significant because it sort of harkens back to her silent comedies with Max Senech. In Nothing Sacred, I think it's probably the most physical of her sound career. She gets into like an actual like fight with Frederick March at one point. He punches her. She punches him back. Yeah.
Mm.
In that film, she basically plays this character who pretends to be dying of radium poisoning, basically to get a free trip to New York. And Frederick March's character sort of catches on, and they try to like hide it from his boss, who works at a newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
So it's another zany film. It's another quintessential screwball comedy, and one that I think really does showcase her talent as a comedian, and especially as a physical comedy performer.
Mm-hmm.
And that was her only film that was shot in Technicolor. So there are not that many photographs of her in color, and even less film footage of her in color. So it's a special treat to watch that movie.
Yeah, so it's called Nothing Sacred?
Nothing Sacred, yes.
Okay, I think I was watching it on TCM when they were doing the Carol Lombard TCM day. I don't know if you caught live for any of that, but
yeah, it was on. Yeah.
Yeah, and I was like, oh, she looks so cute in Technicolor. This is so pretty.
It is. Yeah, she's wearing like a robe for half the movie, and she's like in bed, but for like a good portion of it. But she's despite all that, she's still beautiful. She's her usual sort of feisty, charming self.
So yeah,
it's a really good one. Yeah, I think Nothing Sacred, My Man Godfrey, 20th Century, and my favorite movie, To Be or Not To Be, are probably like her quintessential films. If you're just getting into Carol, I would suggest watching any one of those.
Okay.
And then basically like the last thing I wanted to say about her career in Hollywood that I think is actually quite significant is that after her Paramount.
All right, can you start over what you were saying?
Yes. So, by the end of Carol's Paramount contract, instead of signing another long-term contract with a particular studio, she decided to go freelance. And so, basically in the 1930s, going freelance was far less common than it was in like the post-war era. And she was really one of the first stars to do that. And Carol, in fact, in addition to going freelance, which at the time was quite unusual, she was the first star to have profit participation in her short-term contracts.
Oh, would you explain what that means?
Yes. So profit participation, basically, you take the actor takes a reduced salary up front, and then they'll make a percentage of the profits of a film once it reaches a certain threshold at the box office. So, for example, for Carol, she signed a three-picture contract with David O. Selznick in 1937, and so she signed to make $100,000 per movie, and then 20% of all the profits after each of the films made $1 million at the box office. So, yeah, Carol, I mean, I think it was off the top of my head, I can't remember, 1937 or 1938, she was the highest paid actress in Hollywood. So passive participation was just another means to not only get greater control over your career and obviously you made a lot more money that way. So she, in that sense, sort of was like a trailblazer in terms of like star labor.
Yeah, freelancing is hard, though.
It is. I mean, you have to really, to go freelance, I think, at that time especially, like, you had to have a certain level of, like, fame and power within the industry, right? It's not like anybody could just do that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, people who try to do freelancing now, it's very hard to...
It is.
To get jobs, and I know probably in the age of Corona, it's, like, really hard to get jobs.
Oh, I can't even imagine. Like, you're probably, you're competing against so many people, right? And
yeah.
The lack of, like, security, it's probably very, creates a lot of stress, I can imagine.
Was she ever signed to MGM?
No, she wasn't, but she did work for MGM. She didn't make a movie at MGM, I should say. She made The Gay Bride, which she considered, like, one of her worst movies. But her husband, Clark Gable, was signed to MGM.
Yes. So why don't we talk about the husbands?
Okay. So Carol was married twice, the first to William Powell, and they met on the set of Man of the World in 1931.
Mm-hmm.
And so they got married on June 26, 1931, mm-hmm. and they were only married for 2 years. They got divorced in August of 1933.
Mm-hmm.
Over the course of that marriage, they also made another film together called Ladies' Man.
Mm-hmm.
So Bill was 16, I believe, years older than her.
What?
And, yeah.
Oh, my God. Are you kidding?
Yeah. No.
What is with these actresses and older men? Like, I don't understand.
I know. It gets a little... It's creepy.
It's so uncomfortable for me. Like...
Yeah. No, it is.
Like, Deanna's second husband was 20 years older than she was. Her third husband was 15 years older. And I'm like, what is wrong with marrying people your own age?
Oh, my God. Did she stay married to her third husband?
She did.
Okay.
Yeah, they lasted the longest.
I don't know. It's weird. And so Bill Powell's third wife too, she was substantially younger. She was even younger than Carol. So
oh my God.
But they lasted. Yeah, they stayed married though until the end of his life. So I guess it worked out. But yeah, it's a big age gap. And actually, I think that was like one of the things that ultimately led them to divorce, because obviously they were at different phases in their life and they kind of probably wanted different things out of marriage, right? Because he, it's understandable, right?
Yeah, like, I know people are like, well, that there's not a big age difference between 25 and 43, and, there is a huge difference in maturity level.
100%.
Like, yeah, like maturity level, spiritual level, you know, whatever your brain is going through at the time, but definitely maturity level for sure. So
absolutely.
I'm sure she probably was young when she married him.
Yeah, right. And he was more of an established star, right? So to have this like older, famous man sort of give you attention, I can imagine it was quite flattering, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think, he had already divorced his first wife. They had a child together. So I think he wanted a more sort of like domestic, quiet life. And she was still starting her career, and she wanted to work on her craft and to, I guess, be more social. So they divorced, but they remained very good friends. And she actually helped him through very difficult times in his life, obviously with the death of Jean Harlow, and then he, which is tragic. She died like Carol so young, and then Bill also had cancer. He was diagnosed with rectal cancer in 1937. So Carol helped him through that. So I think like even though they got divorced, they had a really solid friendship, which I think is nice, I guess.
Yeah, for sure.
And then before we get to Clark Gable, I feel like I just have to mention Russ Colombo, because some people argue that Russ Colombo is the love of Carol's life, which I'm personally not necessarily inclined to believe that, maybe. But so basically after she divorced William Powell, she started dating Russ Colombo, the singer. They were together for a very short amount of time, basically until his death in 1934. He was accidentally shot. His friend was basically like playing with a gun and it went off and it shot him.
Oh man.
Her relationship, it's quite gruesome. Their relationship, it was very passionate, I think, but in my opinion, it was a little weird. If you read their personal letters, he seemed very obsessed with her and very sort of like possessive and jealous, particularly of Bill Powell and the friendship that she still had with him. And in one of the letters, she actually refers to herself as like a mother to him, and Russ Colombo is like her child, which is a little strange, not gonna lie.
That is a little strange.
Yeah, so people say that they were going to get married before he died, which they probably were, and I think she did love him, but I think the dynamics are a little strange in that relationship.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Clark Gable.
How'd she meet Clark?
Clark Gable. Yeah. So they met in 1932. They made a movie called No Man of Her Own. And at the time, though, they were both married to other people. She was married to William Powell at the time, so they never had a relationship while they were filming. And then they ran into each other over the years socially. But then they officially started dating. They met again at the Mayfair Ball. This is like an annual party that Hollywood threw every year. So they met at this party in January of 1936. And basically they began dating from that point on. And for me, what's most interesting about their relationship is that at the time, Clark Gable was legally still married to his second wife when Carol and he went public with their relationship.
Who was his second wife?
Rhea. Clark, so like Carol and Bill, Clark also married much older women. His first two wives were significantly older than him.
Oh my God.
They're kind of, he's a whole other, I mean, he could, I don't know if he even wanted to do an episode on him, but he's a whole other topic. So basically though, when I was doing my research for my book, I found what was so interesting to me is that the fan magazines and like studio publicity, they treated his wife as like the other woman, even though Carol was technically like the mistress.
Yeah.
But basically, like his wife was seen as like preventing, is like standing in the way of Carol and Clark's happiness. I found an article from 1938 that said basically Rhea was giving Clark an unhappy life, and that depressed him, and that basically was one of the reasons why he had to go, you know, he began dating Carol. So it's just a very interesting way that their relationship prior to their marriage was framed. Rhea, for her part, she was like holding out in divorcing Clark. Clark was a bit of a cheapskate, and he really didn't want to pay her, I think, the alimony that she wanted. And she also liked being Mrs. Clark Gable. But eventually they divorced in March 1939, and then Carol and Clark got married on March 29th, 1939. And then they settled on a ranch in Encino that Carol paid for and bought from director Raoul Walsh. And they sort of lived their life, basically, until Carol died in 1942.
So for those of you who don't know who Raoul Walsh is, if y'all want some context, he's Miriam Cooper's husband.
Sorry, I couldn't hear you.
I was going to say, for those of you who don't know who Raoul Walsh is, let me give you some context. He's Miriam Cooper's husband.
Yes.
And yes. Most people are like, who's Miriam Cooper? A silent actress, let me put it that way.
Yes.
They were married for a long time until they got divorced because he cheated on her. But that's fun.
Oh, no.
That's fun and games. Their son, their son walked in on another woman in their bed, and he was, and he went, She writes about it, all about in her book, Lady of the Silence. Her book is hilarious.
Oh, I have to read that. Terrible.
Oh, I know.
I don't like him now.
Oh, yeah. I never really cared for Raoul Walsh. I mean, he made some great movies, yeah. But personally, well, not the greatest dude.
That's my feeling with Clark Gable. Like, I think he's handsome. I find that he has a lot of, like, on-screen charisma. But as a person, I don't really like
I don't like him either. I don't like him either. If
No, I don't.
Like, he's in Red Dust, and I'm having to stomach him in Red Dust. But that's because I'm stomaching it for Mary Astor and Gene Harlow.
Her and Gene Harlow, like, make up for it, right?
Yes, absolutely. But I don't, like, everyone's like, ooh, Clark Gable! And I'm just like, No.
Yeah. He's like overconfident, like cocky. He plays that very well.
Yeah, he acts like he's better than everyone else, and that's kind of like he's like, "Well, look at me. I'm Clark Gable." And I'm just like, "Dude, just not the greatest."
Yeah. Carol liked to sort of poke fun at him about that in his known as, like, the king of Hollywood, and so she would, like, make fun of him, basically, and sort of try to make sure his ego was always in check, which I think is good.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Well, tell me, how did you get into Carole Lombard?
So I worked in high school at a video store that had a huge classical Hollywood section, and so basically I spent all my everything I made back at the store, and they had the Carole Lombard Glamour Collection on sale, and so I bought that, and I thought, hey, I really like her, there's something about her, I think it was like her charisma, her spunk on camera, she just, I don't know, there's something about her that really sort of spoke to me, and so I kind of made her my person that I researched, and I wrote about her in college, and then I made her the subject of my dissertation, so it's been a long road with Carol.
Yeah, because I know that they have released some box sets of Carole Lombard, at least some.
Yeah, I think Kino did a box set recently.
Yeah, Kino Lobert does amazing box sets.
Yes, they do such nice work.
Yeah, they did a Deanna Durbin one recently, which I'm asking Yes, and they did a Reginald Denny one, which Emily sent me, which was really wonderful. I'm waiting for them to do a Robert Cummings one. That's what I want.
Oh, that'd be so good.
Yeah. I was thinking, because Carol never worked with Robert Cummings, did she?
No.
They met, but I don't think that they worked together.
I can see them being a good on-screen couple. Mm-hmm. I feel like they would have good chemistry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a shame. Yeah, there's so many people that I wish she could have worked with. I mean, she made a drama with Cary Grant, but she never made a screwball comedy with him. So I'm why?
Were all of her movies comedies?
No, so basically during that time when she went freelance, she was sort of like over being cast in screwball comedy. She felt like she was being typecast. Mm-hmm. So they're basically a period between 1939 and 1940 where she made four straight dramas.
Mm-hmm.
So she made Made for Each Other, In Name Only, Vigil in the Night, and They Knew What They Wanted.
Mm.
And I would definitely watch those because I think they give you a sense of like the breadth and depth of her abilities as a performer. I think she's a really underrated dramatic actress.
Mm-hmm.
I think Jez obviously most well known as a screwball comedian, but she was really good in dramas as well.
I did catch Life for Vigil in the Night, and because it has Anne Shirley in it.
Yes.
And I didn't realize, and I was,
sister.
Yeah, and I didn't realize that she was in there. So I was like, ooh, Anne Shirley. Then I was like, I didn't realize. I was like, oh, that looks like Carol Lombard. And I typed it out. I was like, oh, it is Carol Lombard. I was right.
Yes. It's good casting because they do look similar.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Indeed.
Yeah. No, it's a good movie. It's like very different from her screwball comedies, obviously, and they didn't really do well because of that. I think audiences sort of, they didn't say, they were sort of like lukewarm towards her film, mm-hmm. towards those films, not necessarily because she was acting poorly, but because she was like so different from like the screwball characters that they were used to, so
mm-hmm.
that kind of scared her off from doing more dramas.
Yeah,
which is a shame.
Oh,
and so, like, the end of her career, she went back to making comedy. Their last two films were Mr. and Mrs. Smith, with Alfred Hitchcock,
mm-hmm.
And then To Be or Not to Be, which is my favorite movie, was released in 1942 after she died.
So let's talk about how she died, because some people do not know.
Yeah, so it's pretty heavy. Mm-hmm. So basically, not long after Pearl Harbor, Hollywood sort of went into high gear with trying to organize activities for the war effort for World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And so different people in the industry were volunteering for different duties. Carol volunteered, and it was decided that she would go on a war bonds tour in Indiana. So she went back to where she was born.
Mm-hmm.
On January 12th, 1942, she, her mom, and MGM press agent and her friend Otto Winkler, they left L.A. by mm-hmm. train for Indiana, mm-hmm. and then they got there on the 14th. On the 15th, she hosted war bond rallies,
mm-hmm.
And she actually raised just over like $2 million worth of war bonds in a single day, which, yeah, really impressive, right? I don't
wow.
know if that is in like our current dollar value.
Now probably about $40 million.
Yeah, it's a lot of money. Mm-hmm. I think that like it's impressive, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so this is where things get a little bit tricky because there are a lot of sort of rumors swirling about the circumstances leading up to her death.
Mm-hmm.
Some argue that as they were leaving to go back home to L.A., her and her mom basically flipped a coin to decide how they would get home. Her mom wanted to take the train, and Carol wanted to fly to get back home sooner.
Mm-hmm.
Carol's mom was very superstitious. She was into numerology, mm-hmm. and she thought that the number 3 was apparently bad luck, and there were a lot of bad omens surrounding them and the number 3.
Uh-huh.
Like, Carol was 33 at the time. They were traveling in a party of 3. The flight number was TWA, flight 3. So, basically, Carol won the coin toss, so says the rumor, and they took a plane home. I personally don't believe that rumor, because I think it sort of is, like, too tragic, too, overly romantic in the sense that it sort of enhances the already tragic element of her death, but that's just my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Another rumor I think I should also mention about her death is that there was a rumor that she found out that Clark was having an affair with Lana Turner, and that sort of prompted her to
great.
Fly home.
Oh.
Yeah. So, Lana Turner denied it mm-hmm. her entire life, again, I'll take her word for it. Not, I think Clark definitely did cheat on Carol throughout her life, but I don't necessarily maybe believe that he was cheating on her with Lana Turner. I also don't think that Carol would be, like, that unprofessional that she would abruptly leave this government-sponsored trip to Indiana early just
mm-hmm.
to go home and sort of, you know, chew Clark out. So
mm-hmm.
I kind of don't really believe that story anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, I feel like I had to address those because those fan fans talk about both of those things a lot, and I'm kind of like on the other side of the spectrum in terms of those rumors. So, but anyway, so Carol and her party ended up taking the plane home, and so the plane made a number of stops basically on the way back to LA. Mm-hmm. On the last leg of their journey home, they had just taken off from Las Vegas, and only like a few minutes after takeoff, their plane crashed into the side of Mount Potosi, which is just outside of Vegas.
Oh.
And everybody on board was killed immediately.
Oh, man.
And yeah, and Carol was very young. She was only 33. And it's tragic, right? Because I think she had a lot that she still wanted to accomplish personally and professionally. Sad that her life was cut so short.
Yeah, Helen Parrish died at age 35, 36 of cancer, and I'm just
so
like, God. They were
so
young. They were
young. It's tragic, and I think as like I get closer to that age, like it's even harder that like, oh my God, just it's terrible. And so after that, basically, Clark went to Vegas to try to basically retrieve her remains, and he brought them home by train, and she had her funeral, which is a private affair, and that basically, her death prompted him basically to enlist in the Air Force, which he did in August of that year. It's sort of like in tribute to her, which this is nice.
Mm-hmm. Something he did right.
Yeah. Yes, one thing.
Mm. Hmm.
Yeah, so that's unfortunately a very tragic end to Carol's life. But I think despite that, she was a prolific actress, a wonderful person. So I think those are the things that should be focused on more than the circumstances of her death, right?
Yeah. Are any of her relatives still alive?
So her brother Fred has one son. He's turning 80 like next month.
Uh-huh.
So he's the only one, but he was born 1940, so he really was too young to sort of remember her, but he does have a lot of recollections of through his father of his aunt. I think Fred, her brother, has spoken to him at length about, you know, losing his mom and his sister at the same time, which is very traumatic.
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah. So it's a very small family tree, but they're still around.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Well, thank you so much for joining me on this episode, even though we did have a little bit of a glitch.
Yes. Hopefully not too terrible. But
no, I can edit it, so no worry.
Good. So thank you. Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I had a blast.
Oh, of course. So thank you so much for reaching out and saying, hey, let's do this episode about Carol Lombard, since I don't know anything next to nothing about Carol Lombard.
Absolutely.
Can people buy your book?
Yes. So it's a bit expensive, I will say. But, I mean, if you're welcome to purchase it, it's at Bloomsbury, or you can buy it on Amazon. Unfortunately, it's in hardcover right now, but hopefully they'll make a paperback version soon, so it'll be a little cheaper.
Okay. Well, great. Well, again, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for joining us on this episode of Movie Magic, and we will see you next time.